Okay, then let me welcome everyone to the to this week's group meetings. This week we have Julian Arnold from Basel, and he produced some nice work on machine learning of face transitions in the last few years. So please go ahead and report on that.
Yeah, thanks everyone for having me here today. So special thanks, of course, goes to Sebastian, who invited me to give this talk. So today I'm going to present you some recent results on replacing neural networks by optimal predictive models for the detection of face transitions. And most of what I'm going to talk about today is covered in this paper by myself and Frank Schaefer, who finished his PhD in our group and is now a postdoc at MIT in the Julia lab. So for a brief outline, I'll give you a short primer on face transitions and introduce you to the systems we'll analyze. And then I'll motivate the use of neural networks to detect face transitions and explain you three popular machine learning methods which do this. And in the end, I'll tell you how and why we replace these neural networks by optimal predictive models. So I'm sure all of you know the 2D Ising model, which is the prototypical classical model from statistical mechanics, which exhibits a face transition. So just to recap, its Hamiltonian is given as follows, where neighboring spin variables sigma I and sigma j are coupled. And when j is positive, these want to align with each other in order to minimize the system's energy. And the system is completely characterized by a spin configuration sigma, which denotes the value of these binary spin variables at all sides of the lattice. So we consider the system to be in thermal equilibrium, and therefore the probability to draw a particular spin configuration sample is given by the Boltzmann distribution. And so at low temperature, the interaction between the spins will dominate and all spins will be aligned. And as we increase the temperature, thermal fluctuations take over, and eventually the system is completely disordered, and there will be a phase transition between these two phases of matter. Now, clearly, we can reveal this phase transition by looking at the magnetization per site, which serves as an order parameter in this case. So if we plot the average magnetization per site, this quantity drops from 1 at low temperature, deep within the paramagnetic phase, to 0 at high temperature, deep within the paramagnetic phase. And the critical temperature in this case can be calculated analytically, and it's given by Onsager solution. So at this point, you might wonder, well, why would we even need a neural network for detecting phase transitions? We can calculate the critical temperature analytically, and we can easily find an order parameter based on the samples which highlights the transition. And while this is true for the Ising model, in general, models cannot be treated analytically, and it's not a trivial task to identify an order parameter which describes the transition. So to illustrate this point, let's look at a few other systems. In particular, the Ising gauge theory, which is defined by the following Hamiltonian. So here P denotes plaquettes, which consist of the four spins on the edges of a given square of a two-dimensional lattice. And now for a positive J, the energy is minimized when the product of the spin variables on all plaquettes is equal to plus one. So when there's an even number of spins pointing in the same direction on all plaquettes. And again, we draw spin configurations from a Boltzmann distribution. So at low temperature, the system will occupy its ground state, which is a highly degenerate manifold, comprised of all the states where this product over the plaquettes is equal to plus one. And as the temperature is increased, the system will start to leave this ground state manifold and occupy excited states. And there will be a critical crossover temperature defined by the first appearance of one plaquette with a product of minus one. So this topological crossover can be best spotted by considering the topological nature of the ground state phase. So by connecting all the black spins pointing down on a given spin configuration, we obtain a so-called Wilson loop representation. So here notes that we have periodic boundary conditions. So in the ground state, all of these loops will be closed. And when a plaquette flips, we leave this ground state, and this results in the breaking of a loop, which is here denoted by these red crosses. So due to the topological nature of the system, it is quite hard by eye to distinguish between the ground state phase or configuration samples from that phase compared to configuration samples from the excited state phase if you don't have any access to the Hamiltonian or this Wilson loop representation. So now for our last example, we're going to consider a 1D Bose-Hubbard chain, which is described by the following Hamiltonian. So here bosons can hop between sites and the hopping strength is given by this parameter J. And there will be an on-site interaction with strength U, which we're going to fix throughout our simulations. And we also have a quasi-periodic potential, which modulates each site. And this quasi-periodic potential can vary due to this offset phi, which we're going to sample uniformly at random. And this mimics on-site disorder, whose strength is given by this parameter W. And eventually we're going to prepare many different instances of disorder by sampling this variable phi. And for each this fixed disorder realization, so for each fixed Hamiltonian, we're going to initialize the system in a mod insulating state, so where all the sites are occupied by one boson, and we're going to let the system evolve unitarily for a long time. And at low disorder strength, the system is expected to thermalize and long-range correlations are expected to appear. While above a critical disorder strength, the system thermalization breaks down and the system becomes localized instead. So it features a many-body localization transition. And such a quantum system is particularly challenging to study because it's a non-equilibrium system. And so therefore, many of the standard tools developed for systems in equilibrium do not apply to the many-body localization transition, and as such, it's still an open field of research. So having seen how difficult it can be to characterize phases of matter and identifying phase transitions, it would be great if we could perform this task in an automated fashion from readily accessible data, be it from numerical simulations or experiments. And clearly, this approach would have the advantage that it would not depend on prior theoretical knowledge of the system, for example, of the relevant order parameters or the nature of the phase at play, so whether they're topological or not. And if we had such a generic tool, this could really enable us to identify unexplored phase transitions and potentially discover new phases of matter. And in parallel, deep neural networks have proven to be very successful in traditional image classification tasks. So looking back, for example, at the spin configurations of the Ising-Gage theory, it seems plausible that neural networks could also be used to classify phases of matter instead. In fact, this was the motivation behind many of the machine learning methods for detecting phase transitions, which we know of today. So in this talk, I'm going to focus on three particular methods for detecting phase transitions from data, which are all based on neural networks. And we'll call these supervised learning, learning by confusion, and prediction-based method. And since their inception, these methods have been successfully applied to various different systems. Now, all of these methods follow a similar workflow, which is depicted here. So the system we look at is shown on the right and is characterized by a single tuning parameter P. And we're going to draw samples, which we know by X, of the probability distribution, big P, underlying the system at various values of this tuning parameter. So for example, in the case of the Ising model or the Ising-Gage theory, the tuning parameter would be the temperature and we would sample spin configurations from Boltzmann distributions at different temperatures. Now, once we have done this sampling procedure, the samples we're going to use as input to the neural network can either be directly the raw spin configurations or in principle, any other observable derived from them. And then once we've done that, we're going to train a neural network to minimize a given loss function, meaning we train it to perform a particular task. And once we have trained the neural networks, we analyze their predictions, y hat, and based on these, we're going to compute a scalar quantity, a scalar indicator of phase transitions I at each of the capital K sampled values of the tuning parameter. And ideally, this indicator will then peak at the critical value of the tuning parameter, where the phase transition occurs, which is here shown in red. And the three methods that I've shown you differ in their choices of loss function and how we compute the indicator based on the predictions. So in supervised learning, we generally define two regions, one and two, at the edges of the sampled parameter range, which contain our training data. And all the data in region one is going to be given the label one, y of x equals to one. And all the data drawn in region two is going to be given the label y of x equals to zero. And then we're going to train a neural network to correctly predict the labels of this training data. That is, we're going to train it to correctly to minimize binary cross entropy loss. And so after that, we can compute the mean prediction at each sampled value of the tuning parameter, which includes the intermediate regions, which were not part of the training. And here on the right, I show you a typical behavior of this mean prediction in black as a function of the tuning parameter. And this mean prediction will ideally vary from one at low values of the tuning parameter to zero at high values of the tuning parameter. And there will be a transition between these two values, which can be highlighted by computing the derivative of these mean predictions. And this will serve as our indicator of phase transitions. So here in blue, the blue curve shows this indicator, so the negative derivative of the mean predictions, which are shown in black. And ideally, this indicator then peaks, also this, it will peak where the mean predictions change most. And ideally, this peak is then located at the critical value of the tuning parameter where the phase transition occurs. Now, learning by confusion works in a similar fashion. So what we're going to do here is we're going to split the sampled parameter range into two regions, region one and region two. And this split can be specified by a bipartition parameter. And where all the samples drawn at parameter values less than the bipartition parameter belong to region one and are going to be assigned the label one. And all the samples drawn at larger values belong to region two and are going to be given the label zero. So now obviously there are k plus one different bipartitions if we sampled k distinct tuning parameter values. And for each such bipartition, we're going to train a neural network to correctly label our data. And we're going to compute the mean classification accuracy of our model. And this mean classification accuracy then serves as our indicator. So having trained neural networks for all bipartitions, we can plot this mean classification accuracy as a function of the bipartition parameter, which will ideally have a W shape, which peaks at the transition point. So the classification accuracy reaches one at the edges because for those values, also for these bipartitions, all the data is given the same label, making the task of the neural network trivial. But as we move away from these edges, eventually the classification accuracy starts to increase again, and we have a peak in the middle, which intuitively arises because in this case, the structure present in the data matches the labeling. And so it's easiest for the neural network to predict the correct labels. Now, finally, in the prediction-based method, each sample is labeled by the value of the tuning parameter at which it was generated. So in the case of the Ising model or the Ising gauge theory, this will be the temperature at which the sample was drawn. And because our labels are now continuous, we're going to use a mean square error loss. And after training, we again compute the mean predictions of our network at each sampled value of the tuning parameter. And if we plot this quantity here shown in black, it will ideally be constant at low values of the tuning parameter and at high values of the tuning parameter, that is deep within the two phases. And the predictions will be most susceptible at the phase boundary. And we can capture this susceptibility by computing the derivative of the deviation of the predictions from the two values delta y. And so the indicator is simply given by the change in the mean prediction up to a constant offset. And so in blue, you see this optimal indicator corresponding to the mean predictions that are shown in black. And again, ideally the peak in this this indicator marks the critical value of the tuning parameter. Now, as I said before, these methods have been applied to various different systems. So what exactly is the problem? Overall, we still lack a clear understanding of the working principle of these methods. And this can partially be attributed to the heuristic fashion in which they have been proposed, namely based on the success of neural networks in traditional image classification tasks. And on top of that, large neural networks are expensive to train and in general difficult to interpret. And as such, it's largely unclear when and why a given method fails or succeeds. So to illustrate this on a concrete example, let's look at the results of this paper by Eliska Grablova from 2020, where they analyzed the Ising gauge theory using learning by confusion and the prediction-based method. So the left panel shows the indicator of learning by confusion for the Ising gauge theory with a lattice size 12 as a function of the inverse temperature beta, which is our tuning parameter in that case. And here the characteristic W shape in gray is not present, and instead the signal they observe is distorted. And as such, one cannot identify the critical value of the tuning parameter based on learning by confusion. However, it's difficult to make rigorous statements about this observation because the results ultimately depend on the choice of hyperparameters and the degree of convergence which has been achieved. But even when a method succeeds, it can be unclear what it bases its predictions on. So here you see the indicator of the prediction-based method for the Ising gauge theory for various lattice sizes, which correctly highlights the topological crossover. And in their paper, the authors found that the peak positions agree well with predictions based on a physically motivated density of states model. And this is strong evidence on what the neural network learns, but still not conclusive. So to summarize, when using neural networks, there seems to be a trade-off. High model capacity, so the ability to approximate a large variety of functions accurately, comes hand in hand with low interpretability and high computational costs. And there have been many works up to now trying to regain this interpretability by lowering the model capacity. So this can be done, for example, by using linear methods such as support vector machines, which are easy to interpret due to their linear nature, or by engineering input features or reducing the neural network size systematically, such that the final neural network can again be well approximated by a linear function. Or using standard interpretability tools for machine learning, many of which analyze the dependence of the output on the input data via truncated Taylor expansion, and therefore they really only capture the neural network behavior in lower order. And while these approaches are nice, ultimately, by following them, we trade in the advantage of neural networks over linear models in that they are highly expressive and can act as universal function approximators. Now, in our work, we take a different approach to this trade-off. We have seen that each of the three methods follows such a workflow where we train a neural network to perform a certain task through minimization of a loss function. Now, what we did is we derived analytical expressions for the predictions y hat opt, which minimize these loss functions. And these predictions are optimal in the sense that the corresponding model forms the classification or regression task specified by the loss function optimally. And because neural networks are universal function approximators, we will reach this optimal model asymptotically in the limit of infinite size after perfect training. So skipping the proofs, here are the analytical expressions for the optimal predictions of supervised learning, learning by confusion, and the prediction-based method. So here P1 and P2 of X denotes the cumulative probability of drawing the input X either in region one or region two. So PK of X is the probability to obtain the input X at the kth sampled value of the tuning parameter. And the predictions, these optimal predictions in supervised learning and learning by confusion are identical in form, but differ due to the different choice of regions one and region two. The optimal prediction for a given input X in these two methods is given by the probability of drawing the input X in region one compared to region two. And similarly, the optimal predictions of the prediction-based method at each sampled value of the Turing parameter is given by weighting each value, sampled value of the Turing parameter by the probability of obtaining the sample X at that point compared to all other points. So once we have an optimal predictive model, which shows these optimal predictions, we can proceed in the same fashion as for a neural network to obtain the corresponding indicators, which we now call optimal indicators. Now, how does this help us in terms of interpretability? Well, the analytical expressions directly reveal the dependence of the output on the input data. So even before looking at explicit examples, we can already make an interesting observation. So these expressions are only dependent on the input X through the probability distributions. And because the methods gauge changes in these predictions Y hat, they therefore detect changes in the underlying probability distributions and phase transitions manifest themselves as rapid changes in these distributions. So evaluating the optimal predictions, so to construct an optimal predictive model, boils down to knowing these underlying distributions, pk of x. And we can utilize different ways, or we can approach this problem in different ways. So we can utilize analytical expressions or exact numerical evaluations of the probability distribution if there are available, or we can obtain numerical estimates from drawn samples. In the simplest case, we estimate the probability to obtain the sample X at the kth value of the Turing parameter as follows, where mk of X is the number of times the sample X has been drawn, and m is the total number of drawn samples. And if we do this in such a way, the corresponding predictions will be empirically optimal, meaning that they will not minimize the true loss, but they will minimize the empirical loss, which is the training loss, so that loss based on our finite set of training data. Now, how close are these empirically optimal predictions to the true optimal predictions? That will in general depend on the data set size. So for small data sets, one typically observes that the empirical loss, so L train, the training loss, gradually decreases as a function of the capacity of our predictive model. In our approach really corresponds to a predictive model which minimizes this training loss. So it probes the high capacity limit. However, for a small data set, there will generally be a difference between this empirical training loss and the true loss shown in red. And this is called the generalization gap. So eventually, as we increase the capacity of our predictive model, the true loss will also start to increase again, a behavior which we call overfitting. And the ideal fit, so the predictive model which minimizes or achieves the lowest value of the true loss, will then be not located in this high capacity limit, but it will be achieved by a model with intermediate model capacity. And as we increase the size of our data set, this generalization gap closes and the minimum of the true loss coincides with the minimum of the empirical training loss. And in this regime, the empirically optimal predictions constructed by our approach will therefore also be close to the true optimal predictions. Now, of course, one can also reach this high model capacity limit by training neural networks. So how does this approach compare to ours? So when training neural networks, one searches the space of functions by tuning its weights and biases to minimize the loss. And in the process, we traverse the loss landscape trying to find its minimum. So if we really want to reach the global minimum of the loss function, that is an optimal or empirically optimal model, we'll need to use large neural networks, train for many epochs, perform hyperparameter tuning, while in the end, we still don't have any guarantee of convergence. And this search is made obsolete in our approach because per construction, it yields an optimal or empirically optimal model that minimizes the loss. And we find that the computation time it takes to construct the optimal indicator, so the quantity which will then highlight the phase transitions, is comparable with a single epoch in neural network training when we use a minimal neural network with a single hidden layer and a single hidden node. However, in practice, of course, one needs to use larger neural networks, train for more epochs, and needs to adjust hyperparameters. And this is where the advantage of our approach in terms of raw computation time comes in. However, the advantage of neural networks is that they may yield better approximations of the optimal predictions compared to our construction if one works in the small data regime. Now let's see how we can utilize optimal predictive models in practice. And we're going to start with the classical equilibrium systems where the underlying probability distributions are Boltzmann. So in that case, one can prove that the optimal predictions are the same when using the raw sample configurations as input or the energy. And this is because the energy in that case is a sufficient statistic. And this is interesting for two reasons. First, because we can work in the space of allowed energies that typically only scales polynomially with the system size compared to the exponential growth of the set of allowed sample configurations. And this is really crucial for pushing us into the large data regime where the empirically optimal predictions we construct are going to be close to the true optimal predictions. And second, it establishes that for classifying phases of matter for a classical equilibrium system along the temperature, so if we sweep the temperature, if we want to do this optimally with the three models we consider, the energy is really the single feature of a sample that matters. So as a concrete example, we consider the Ising-Gauge theory. So on the right, you see how the probability of having a particular energy per site changes as a function of our tuning parameter, which is the temperature, where black color denotes high probability and the temperature increases from left to right. And we obtained this distribution via Monte Carlo sampling. So at low temperature, the system occupies its ground state. And as we move to higher temperatures, we start to occupy states which lie higher in energy. The red line denotes the crossover temperature, marking the temperature at which plaquettes start to flip. And based on our Monte Carlo data, we can compute the empirically optimal predictions and indicators of supervised learning as a function of the tuning parameter, which is here shown on the right. So here, the optimal predictions y hat opt are shown in black, and the optimal indicator is shown in blue. And we see that the predictions rapidly drop from 1 to 0 around the critical value of the tuning parameter and its derivative, the indicator in blue, correctly highlights the transition. And this inset shows the peak position of the optimal indicator, so really our best guess for the phase transition based on this method, as a function of the linear lattice size L, and it exhibits this expected scaling behavior. So here one can also additionally leverage the fact that the underlying probability distributions are Boltzmann to derive that the optimal predictions of supervised learning at a given value of the tuning parameter, PK, are proportional to the probability of drawing the ground state, which is the relevant feature for identifying the topological crossover in the Ising-Gauge theory. So we can explicitly confirm that supervised learning, if performed optimally, tracks variations in the appropriate physical quantity. So here you see the optimal indicator of learning by confusion, which shows a distorted W shape. So nevertheless, its peak lies close to the correct critical parameter value. So recall that learning by confusion was previously found to fail for the Ising-Gauge theory. So if we choose the same parameter range as in the paper by Eliska, we qualitatively obtain the same indicator signal. So on the left, you see the indicator of learning by confusion that they obtained by training neural networks, whereas our results obtained by evaluating these analytical expressions are shown on the right. And here we can explicitly confirm that learning by confusion fails for the Ising-Gauge theory for this particular choice of parameter range. Now, the indicator of the prediction-based method correctly highlights the value of the tuning parameter, and the location of the peak coincides with the one from supervised learning. So recall that in the paper by Alishka, it was found that the predictions of the prediction-based method closely match the predictions obtained by a density of states-based model, which they motivated in a heuristic fashion. So we can show that the optimal predictions of this prediction-based method are in fact equivalent to this density of states-based model if one restricts oneself to a Boltzmann distribution. And so this exposes the inner workings of the method. And we can analyze other systems in a similar fashion. So let's look at our results for the Ising model. So here you see the probability distributions governing its energy. And the peak in the indicator of supervised learning, where we choose region 1 and 2 at t equals 0 and at a high temperature value, is shown in blue. And in this case, it misses the critical tuning parameter value. But as we saw previously, this is really due to the fact that for such a choice of training regions, one can show that supervised learning tracks the probability of obtaining the ground state, which in the Ising model already drops significantly for parameter values below the critical value. Now, the optimal indicator of learning by confusion nicely highlights the critical value, while the optimal indicator of the prediction-based method shows two distinct peaks. One which coincides with the peak in supervised learning, which is the more prominent one, and one which occurs at the critical value. And so it turns out that this double peak structure has already been observed in the original paper proposing this prediction-based method. So finally, we can look at the many-body localization transition in the Bose-Hubbard chain. So here we see the probability distribution underlying the input data. So for a given disorder strength W, the plot shows the probability of obtaining a given Fox state. So that's denoted by the basis index, which we choose as our measurement basis. And this probability is obtained by averaging the final states after simulating the unitary time evolution, starting from the mod insulating state for many different disorder realizations. And the expected range for the critical value of the disorder strength from literature is shown in red. So compared to the previous examples here, it's hard to identify this range by eye just by looking at the probability distributions. But we can look at the line scan, so here in blue, which shows the average probability of retrieving the initial mod insulating state after the time evolution. And this retrieval probability steadily increases as the disorder strength passes a critical value. And this is characteristic for the transition. So here, the optimal indicators of all three methods correctly highlight the phase transition. And because of the large contribution of this mod insulating state compared to all other states in this probability distributions, it is really this retrieval probability that these methods ultimately track. So there has been a recent paper by Annabelle Bort where they analyze this system, both using numerical and experimental data from the Greiner group within the same setting using all of these three methods. And this highlights that in principle, our approach is also applicable to experimental measurement data. So now we've also applied this approach to numerical data from other classical quantum systems.
Oh, hey, Julian, I think you cut out a little bit. So maybe if you want to start the slide over.
Yep. So we've also applied this approach to numerical data from other classical and quantum systems, such as the BKT phase transition in the 2DXY model, or the mod insulator to superfluent transition in the Bose-Hubbard model. And you can ask me later or check out our paper if you want to know more about these results. So far, I have shown you that we these optimal predictive models are useful to detect phase transitions from data in an efficient and interpretable way. And all of these results were obtained by evaluating the corresponding analytical expressions. However, in principle, one can, of course, try to approximate an optimal predictive model by training neural networks. And in the last part of my talk, I want to dive a bit deeper into the differences between these two approaches. So remember that in theory, we recover an optimal model and its predictions in the high capacity limit. So let's see how this can be achieved in practice with neural networks by gradually increasing their capacity. So here I've depicted this schematically. So each circle represents the set of functions that our neural network can approximate to within a certain accuracy. And as we increase the capacity of our neural network, the set grows, and ideally we're able to approximate this optimal model more and more accurately. So there are different factors controlling the capacity. One is, for example, the neural network architecture. So here on the left, you see the indicator of the prediction-based method for the Ising model obtained with neural networks with a single hidden layer with a variable number of nodes, with light blue corresponding to small neural networks. And as we move to dark blue, we increase the number of hidden nodes. So the model capacity increases. And the optimal indicator that I've shown you previously is depicted in black. And what we see is that as we increase the model capacity by increasing the number of nodes, this neural network-based indicator approaches the optimal indicator. And you see a similar behavior when varying the capacity, for example, by varying the training time or by introducing an L2 regularization of different strength. So in all three cases, we approach the optimal indicator signal as we increase the capacity. But even more interestingly, in this particular case, low capacity models, so the ones in light blue, show a clear peak or a clear indicator peak at the phase transition, whereas high capacity models, so in particular our optimal indicators, do not. So in a similar fashion, for example, one can correctly identify the phase transition in the Ising model with supervised learning, which you might know from the Nature paper by Tarski and Melko. However, as you have seen during the talk, there are many other instances where optimal models correctly highlight the phase transition. And there, in general, the accuracy of the estimated critical point increases as the model capacity is increased. So this means that both low capacity and high capacity models can be useful as far as you understand. Now, from the behavior I've shown you here, you might be inclined to conclude that the approach without neural networks leads to overfitting. However, remember that the optimal models we have constructed are base optimal, meaning that no other statistical model can outperform it on average on the specified classification or regression task. So on the contrary, it is the case that neural networks with restricted capacity, which in this case seem to correctly highlight the phase transition, are in fact underfitting the data. So this really signals a fundamental mismatch between the learning task as specified by the loss function and our goal of detecting phase transitions. And it will be interesting in the future to see how we can resolve this discrepancy. So in summary, the standard workflow for applying supervised learning, learning by confusion, and this prediction-based method involves neural networks. And their high model capacity can only be achieved at high computational cost, and we largely lose interpretability. And our approach is instead based on constructing optimal non-parametric predictive models. And this corresponds to these models are optimal in the sense that they minimize the loss function. And through this construction, we are able to bypass this trade-off we encountered for neural networks and probe this high capacity limit at low computational cost while retaining some interpretability. So as an outlook, here I've applied this methodology to these three methods. An obvious next step is to generalize the procedure to higher dimensional parameter spaces featuring multiple phases. But one can also think of applying a similar analysis to other neural network-based methods for detecting phase transitions and classifying phases of matter, as well as other tasks in condensed matter, which currently rely on neural networks to be solved. So one can still think of improving the efficiency of a numerical routine. So for example, using more sophisticated machine learning techniques to construct the probability distributions given samples. So for performing density estimation or quantum state tomography. And in particular, our approach is in principle compatible with autoregressive networks and matrix product state representations. And finally, having seen that the indicators of phase transitions which emerge from these machine learning methods ultimately detect changes in the underlying probability distributions. And because of that, it will be interesting to study how these indicators compare to other notions of distances between probability distributions, so statistical distances, and whether one can make a connection to more fundamental quantities such as the Fisher information or the quantum Fisher information, which has been already used in the past to detect phase transitions with similar motivations as our approaches, meaning that they are generic indicators and they don't rely on knowledge of the order parameters. So with that, I'm finished and I thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Julian, for this nice talk. If anyone wants to ask questions, please let me know. Other than that, can I please start asking some questions? So am I correct that your method requires a choice of observables, and that such an observable can either be like one that is already known from any physics derivation, or it can be a neural network or a machine learning algorithm. So it's like, is this an important step? You need to have some kind of observable that you get from somewhere.
So where do you see the observable in our case? So
when you
like the energy or the spin configuration,
your optimal predictors and your probability distributions. So Is there an observable involved? Like, you need to choose either an observable or a machine learning model that you treat as an observable from which you then construct your optimal predictor, right?
Right. All right. So you mean in the sense that sort of this average y hat or whatever it is that you compute this indicator from, if you interpret this as an observable, and either it's maybe it's an order parameter, or maybe it comes from a machine learning model. Is that what you mean?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you can do both, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I'm wondering is then just how do any errors that you make then transfer from the observable that you take and you build your optimal predictor to your optimal predictor? And how would your optimal predictor... So your optimal predictor can only be as sensitive as the observable or machine learning algorithm that you use, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. So I guess you're right in the sense that, you know, this quantity y hat of x, you could also choose another physical quantity to build this y hat. So let's say you say, well, I know that the magnetization is maybe an interesting quantity in that system, and then I try to sort of construct some kind of function which maps to the range of or just to a range between 0 and 1, because that's where this y hat quantity lives.
And but then that's not what you want to do, because you want to assume you don't know the magnetization, right?
Exactly, but my point is that even if you take a physical observable and try to construct such a y hat, the idea, or that's then a predictive model, a map from inputs to labels, whatever you take as an observable, there is sort of an optimal predictive model, right? And maybe if your observable is good, then the predictive model that you construct in such a way will be closer to that optimal predictive model.
Yeah. And then going from there, let's if we just take a very simple example. So it's like we use the divergence in the average expected energy to calculate the phase transition. So it's like if we compare your optimal predictor methods based on choosing the energy and like just methods that like you calculate the average energy and plot it and do your finite size scaling or whatever to estimate your phase transition, what is your advantage that you get?
Right, so that's a really good question. So how I see it is that as I said, this we need to know the energy of our system to make this compression, right? So that's a crucial step, because otherwise, constructing our optimal predictions requires knowledge of the probability distribution. And if you have a Boltzmann distribution and the partition function is intractable, we have to get some approximations of the distribution. And if you just do this naive histogram binning or frequency estimation, as we did, if you apply that to just the raw spin configurations, the number of samples or the state space will just be too big to yield any reasonable estimates of the probability distributions for the samples. So you need to go to the energy to make that useful. And in that sense, you could argue that you lose sort of the advantage of the machine learning models which they had in the first place, meaning that you don't need to know the good quantity to look at. So what I mean is, ideally, or what the neural network based approaches do is they would discover on their own that the energy is an interesting quantity to look at, right? And that's what you basically learn from our analysis.
Yeah, and then I think we can go straight to the place that I found the most interesting, and that is where some neural network based methods get you the wrong phase transition. Can you go to the slides?
Yes, for example, the Ising model, maybe where it's most striking.
Yeah. So it's like that confused me the most. So what is going wrong?
Yeah, so what's going wrong here is, let's take, for example, supervised learning, right? And supervised learning is, okay, you always have to specify on top of that, not just the method, but which sort of training data, what training data do you really consider? So where do you take your training regions to lie? And in our case, so in this, for this particular plot, we chose as region one, t equals zero, and as region two, sort of the highest temperature we had here, t equals
okay, so just
normalized temperature
zero. So no fluctuations. So you don't include any configurations where you have any physical fluctuations above t equals zero.
So there can be. So the plot will look very similar if you include some like data from a finite but small t. Right. So I'm not saying that there's anything special about t equals zero. What you need to get sort of a plot looking like that is that you just need to choose this region one at low enough temperature such that the ground state has the highest probability to being drawn. And then sort of your predictions will be dominated by the ground state.
Yeah.
So that's really the problem, right? Because in supervised learning, what you try to do is you apply your classifier that you get on these intermediate regions. And those intermediate regions are out of distribution. So even if I say the classifier is optimal, it's basically optimal for the case where you give me samples drawn at t equals zero and a large t, right? But not for these intermediate values. And what you would see is that, let's say I choose these training regions differently and I move them closer and closer to the phase transition. So I'm basically sort of giving that's then closer. So the training distribution is closer and closer to the distribution I actually apply the classifier to. Then what you will see is that the peak sort of converges to the correct position. But the problem is basically of course, ideally one would not need to know the point of the phase transition for these methods to be useful. And so basically moving these training regions closer and closer to the critical point requires that knowledge.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, if you're naively going to examine a new model, you would probably either start with unsupervised learning or based on this iterative scheme that you were just describing. You train while you leave out a small window where you don't know that the phase transition is, and then you include more and more data to narrow down and to find a more accurate value of the phase transition temperature or whatever parameter you tune.
Thing is, if you think of supervised learning with this modification of the training range, then you're actually really close to this learning by confusion-based approach, right? Where you sort of consider all possible bipartitions of your region and you just see where you reach the highest classification accuracy.
Yeah. I mean, that's cool. Because so it's like, for me, that was one of the major drawbacks right from the beginning. That was for me one of the reasons why I started with unsupervised learning that includes the intermediate region where you test the model. And when I did my autoencoder method, I did not see Juan's paper, but I wanted to do the same thing. And then I told myself it doesn't make sense because you do out of distribution training and you cannot assign a phase to a single sample. And so it's like what convinced me then was like, if you have, if your probability distributions are so that they include enough fluctuations above the ground state such that they could push your learned model into a direction where the decision function is sandwiched between information that it gets from the high temperature and the low temperature phase. So it's like So in order to make that work, you need to include samples that are of sufficiently high, either sufficiently high temperatures or statistically such that the information that you get from fluctuations above the ground state are so strong that they push the neural net, what is learned by the neural network, close to the real phase transition. So it's like you need to force, so you cannot just naively train your neural network at the zero temperature and a higher temperature. You need to force the neural network to learn fluctuations that pin down the phase transition or that narrow down all possible ranges of the decision function to find the real phase transition. I mean, was it too complicated what I said? I don't know, maybe.
No, I completely agree. So the one interesting thing is maybe that sort of this proof that I've shown that supervised learning really sort of this the probability, the prediction is proportional to the probability of drawing the ground state, meaning that the indicator will peak where the probability of drawing the ground state will change most. That only assumes that this region one, so the one at low temperature, there the ground state dominates. You can actually do whatever you want with the high temperature region. So that means, so just you said you have two scenarios. And actually the first one is also will not help. So even moving to very high temperatures does not help in that case.
What I suggest, the most important thing is that you include fluctuations above your ground state that push your decision boundary close enough to the real phase transition. If you don't, yeah. if you don't have it, the normal there's this extreme ambiguity in learning based on how you, the way you say it on the empirical loss function, where there if you just draw your average phase boundary curve or whatever predictor you have, there's this freedom of choice where to put the phase transition, that is where everything is compatible with the loss function or the observations, but you won't get the real phase transition that you're interested in because the model does not get the information. It will only get the information if you include enough fluctuations above the ground state. My opinion, yeah. Okay, Estelle.
Yeah, that's why you can also like if you choose the training regions as we did in that case, so at very low temperature and at very high temperature, what you can show is that sort of the optimal predictions are based on just tracking the ground state probability. But if you, so that's of course different than the magnetization, right? So that sort of tells you that just for that particular learning task that you've set up, the quantity to look at, which is optimal for the learning task, just doesn't highlight the phase transition optimally. And interestingly, like if you remember in the paper by Karaskia and Melko, they also consider the Ising-Gage theory. And there they train at t equals zero and t going to infinity. And there, of course, everything matches, right, with the optimal predictions and indicators, because that's where the tracking the ground state probability is the right quantity. So there, everything works out.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, yeah, that's an extremely good point, yeah.
And that's also why you can basically get the right peak in supervised learning, even with these boundary regions, if you sort of lower the model capacity, because that effectively just changes the learning task.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it could be that, yeah, maybe there's some intermediate capacity where then the neural network will learn something similar as the magnetization. It's just that the optimal performance you will not get in for that learning task by tracking the magnetization.
I had especially with Everett, a lot of discussions about this model capacity. So what I understand is that especially learning by confusion is extremely susceptible to having a too high model capacity. But let's let Estelle ask her question first. Sorry for letting you wait so long.
No, it's nice discussions. So I had a question about the scalability of your Y hat optimal, because you are kind of avoiding doing histogram by using the representation of the Boson probability distribution, if I got it well, right? But then you compute it over samples, right? But so I imagine that as you scale the system size, unless in your training samples you have a good representation, or unless your ground state, the support of your ground state probability is localized over your samples, I mean, your metric is not going to be well-defined. Am I correct or not?
So you're, of course, right. Like this scaling is an issue with that approach. How we get around it in this case of the classical systems is by sort of realizing that, yeah, we don't need to have accurate probability distribution over the entire state space, just the energy. And for example, for the Ising model, instead of 2 to the L squared possible spin configurations, you would then only have L squared minus 1 allowed energies. So that's sort of getting rid of that scaling. And if you sort of just sample over that space, then sort of you can get reasonable estimates for the probabilities with histogram binning. But that will not, or that basically means that you need to know this quantity to perform a lossless compression. And that's in generally not the case, right? So for the most interesting scenarios where you don't know anything about your system, the whole point is to find a good quantity, which is low dimensional, which characterizes your system, right? So there you cannot perform this. So let's say, for example, in the quantum case,
Yeah, that was my next question. Like something as simple as a quantum is it J at zero temperature? What are you going to do?
Yeah, if you have a quantum system, the cost of our approach, if you apply it to data, right, then it's really the same as tomography, full tomography.
I see.
If you want to include different measurement settings, right? Of course, otherwise it's just estimating sort of all the probabilities in a single basis. But yeah. That's really for sure an issue with this approach. I would say that how I see these methods is more of a way to understand what's going on with the neural network-based approaches, right? So eventually, of course, you will need to make some approximations, but the idea is that with our approach, if you know the probability distributions or you have some low-dimensional, or you know some low-dimensional quantity, such that you can get sufficiently as a good enough statistics, then you can really calculate these optimal indicators. And so, I mean, relevant cases are, for example, like let's say you study these quantum systems in simulation. If you do exact diagonalization studies, or if you have sort of a matrix product state representation, or you have sort of an autoregressive neural network, which represents your quantum state, then you can still calculate these quantities because you have basically access to the probability distributions.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So it's only a problem if you need to reconstruct the probability distributions from samples. And there I agree with you that histogram binning is, run into limitations. So that's why I said there the idea would be to sort of combine it with other methods used to estimate probability distributions efficiently from samples, right?
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. All right, thanks.